My guest today is Robert Perry, a distinguished investigative journalist who became famous for breaking the Iran-Contra story and has written books on the George Bush era, a trilogy about George Bush, which is available online. He became known for his coverage of Iran-Contra for the Associated Press and Newsweek and exposing the psychological operations and guerrilla warfare the CIA manual provided to Nicaraguan Contras and the CIA and Contra cocaine traffic in the U.S. scandal in 1985. For his reporting on Iran-Contra, he was awarded the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1984. He's been doing this for a long time. He's been the editor of Consortium News since 1995, where he continues to be in the forefront of investigative journalism in an age where it's almost disappeared from the mainstream media. He has just written an article, exclusive article, on Consortium News, which I found on June 15th, in which he writes that liberal interventionist Samantha Power, along with her neocon allies, appears to have prevailed in the struggle over how President Obama will conduct his foreign policy in his last months in office, promoting aggressive strategies that will lead to more death and destruction. Welcome once again, Robert Perry, to Takes on the World.
Well, thanks for having me.
This article, as you say, is exclusive because most people have not been paying that much attention to Ukraine. There's a lot of news, particularly the terrorist attack in Charleston, that has taken up much of the discussion, and with all the hand-wringing on the media until the next terrorist attack comes. Tell us about the role that Samantha Power is playing as our UN ambassador.
All right. Basically, if you know the history of Barack Obama, he really didn't know that much about Washington. He was only here for a couple years as a senator before he ran for president and was elected. So he's had a few people who have been around him since the beginning of that period for him, and one of them is Samantha Power. She was known for her aggressive writing on human rights issues, where she condemned political figures for not intervening in some human rights catastrophes where the outsiders might have been some help, and she's carried that view into the White House, first as a national security advisor to President Obama, and then she's continued it as now the U.S. representative to the United Nations. She was instrumental in a couple of serious mistakes, though, or certainly problems that have been created. One was in 2011 when she was a key proponent for the intervention in Libya. At the time, Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, who had been generally cooperating with the United States and the West on a number of issues, was warning about terrorist groups in eastern Libya around the Benghazi area, and struck out against them militarily. Power was part of the effort, along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, to persuade President Obama to go in militarily to stop Gaddafi, and supposedly to protect civilians. But then that humanitarian mission morphed into a regime change mission, where Gaddafi's forces were bombed from the sky, and effectively these rebel forces seized control of Libya and captured and murdered Gaddafi. The results have been quite troublesome since then. The country remains in chaos. Many thousands of people and the tens of thousands have died as a result of these ongoing conflicts. There are two governments claiming control. One is in Tobruk, operating off a boat, a cruise ship, and the other is in Tripoli. The U.S. is sort of recognizing the group on the boat, but the overall chaos has shown that Gaddafi was not delusional when he warned about some of these extremist groups operating in Benghazi. Some of them struck and killed the U.S. ambassador, if you remember, back in 2012. And then subsequently, we now see the Islamic State developing a foothold in the region and carrying out their typical decapitations of religious minorities that they don't like. So you have, sometimes Samantha Power, in what's known as weaponizing human rights, doesn't even achieve the goal of protecting people. In fact, sometimes in these efforts to intervene, the United States makes things worse. And so she's continued in that way. The United States has also gotten very actively involved in Ukraine, pushing for the coup d'etat in 2014 that overthrew the elected government and put in place a pro-U.S. government. And that's led to major crises with both Russia, which is neighboring Ukraine, and has led to a great deal of killing directed against ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine because they resisted the coup and they've been targeted for what's known there as an anti-terrorist operation, which amazingly is being spearheaded by neo-Nazi groups. So we have a very bloody situation in eastern Ukraine, where Samantha Power also has taken fully the side of the regime in Kiev, and operating with very extreme rhetoric, one-sided presentations of the facts, setting the stage really for more what's increasingly like ethnic cleansing in eastern Ukraine. What we see with someone like Samantha Power is what we saw with some of the neoconservatives back in the George W. Bush administration, where their demands to remove some leader who they point to as very flawed or even awful leads to worse violence, in some cases worse leadership, and is very harmful both to the people of that country and more broadly to U.S. national interests.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't see it mentioned in the papers, but I saw it on the internet, that in Congress, John Conyers had a resolution passed to keep funding away from this kind of Azov battalion. There's a group of neo-Nazi Ukrainians, white supremacists, and the white supremacy was the basis, the hook the legislation was hung on. But these Ukrainian fascists are wearing Nazi emblems on, or putting Nazi emblems on their helmets. And the United States government and the defenders of the so-called Ukrainian Maidan independence rally and so on have pretended that these exaggerations, that the charges that were being made by Ukrainians in the East who were not supporting the overthrow of Yanukovych and by Putin were just propaganda and that these, in fact, were good Ukrainians. But it turns out, as you write, that these people have been responsible for some of the bloodiest attacks of this whole period. Maybe you could even talk a little more about that.
Well, sure. I mean, what happened with the situation in Ukraine, and it has been terribly reported by the mainstream news media in the United States and much of Europe, no one seems interested in how this actually came about. The various players, the role of the United States, role of our neoconservatives, because the neoconservatives remain very influential in Washington, even under President Obama. You have in some cases groups like the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a government-funded project, but it's quasi-independent from the U.S. government and has been headed by a guy named Carl Gershman since it was founded in 1983. And Gershman is your classic neocon. He's very much in that camp, and the government gives him $100 million or more to spend on various supposedly pro democracy operations. But they tend to be involved in destabilizing governments that for some reason have come into the crosshairs of the neocons. And we've seen that really in the Western Hemisphere over the last several decades. And we've seen it, we saw it in Ukraine. Gershman went to took to the pages of the Washington Post in 2013 and called Ukraine the biggest prize and a route to ultimately destabilize Russia and get rid of President Putin of Russia. So it was seen even then as a way to achieve a kind of regime change. And then as this argument developed over how quickly Ukraine should join some kind of economic union with Europe while still trying to maintain its relationships with Russia, which was its major trading partner. And when Yanukovych realized it would take more time, he backed out of a deal with the EU in November of 2013. And then you saw a lot of these activist groups, some basically Ukrainian people legitimately concerned about their futures, and others funded partly by the United States and some of the Western governments. Another neocon who remains in a powerful position, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, told a group in late 2013 that the U.S. had invested $5 billion in what she called their European aspirations. So you had all this money sloshing around, and you had people, some of them, you know, rank-and-file Ukrainians who just wanted a different course for their country, and you had others who were on the payroll of U.S.-backed NGOs, and then you had these right-wing extremists who are very strong in Ukraine, going back to the days of World War II when a lot of the folks in Western Ukraine, who saw themselves as pure Ukrainian and resented the Jews and the Poles and the ethnic Russians in their territory, sided with Adolf Hitler's SS and the Nazis as they rolled through Ukraine. There was an auxiliary called the Galician SS, based from in the Lviv area, Western Ukraine, and then there were various paramilitary groups that joined in the Holocaust, And this has never been resolved in Ukraine. It's like a lot of these sort of ancient kind of conflicts where these things go underground a bit, but they don't really end. And they surfaced again in the midst of the Maidan operations. There were major organizations of paramilitary forces, again, in the Lviv area. Hundreds of fighters were shipped daily into Kiev to join the Maidan protests, which started off relatively nonviolently, but as things went on, they escalated, where these neo-Nazis took the lead in attacking the police, throwing firebombs, killing police, and things got increasingly out of hand to get into the February 2014 period. So you had these neo-Nazis then playing a key role in what becomes the coup, which ousts President Yanukovych, who had been elected with large support from eastern and southern Ukraine. He had strong support from the ethnic Russian areas. So, with U.S. backing and encouragement, with people like Victoria Nuland on the scene, she literally passed out cookies to the Maidan protesters, and then she was caught on a phone intercept talking about who should take over. She said Yats is the guy, and which reference to Arseniy Yatsenyuk. And after the coup comes down, a very violent coup comes down on February 22nd of 2014, Yatsenyuk becomes the prime minister. So what we had here was a blatant coup, and it was something that the United States very quickly embraced. As did much of the EU, and it set up what became very quickly a civil war. And the Russians got involved because they had a naval base in Crimea, and the Crimean people, who are heavily ethnic Russians, voted in a referendum, which I guess some didn't want to respect, but it reflected their views, voted by 96% to get out of this failed state of Ukraine and join the Russian Federation, which happened. So that becomes, in the mainstream media of the United States, an invasion, even though the Russian troops actually were already in Ukraine or in Crimea. They were based in Sevastopol. So you had this So you had a combination of things happening. You had the Russians freaking out because they saw these events occurring on their borders, and they also saw attacks aimed at ethnic Russians who were very quickly being killed in significant numbers by some of these neo-Nazi paramilitary groups. And you saw this propaganda campaign much more from the United States side. I know that in the U.S. mainstream media, everyone's supposed to say that the Russian propaganda is all this dominant, powerful force, but frankly, it isn't. There's been much more propaganda in places like the New York Times, pushing these very argumentative themes about Russian aggression, when the story is much more muddled than that. It's a much more complicated story where you don't have black hats versus white hats. You have a lot of people in gray hats. But that doesn't, I guess, that's not the narrative that the Times and the Washington Post and other major news organizations want to present. They want to present it as a white hat versus black hat situation, and that has misled the American people substantially. So but interestingly, as you mentioned, that one is that among the groups that has been organized to kill ethnic Russians in the East is the Azov Battalion. It's not the only far-right battalion operating, but it's one that is filled with Nazis, people running around with swastikas and SS symbols, and there's a neo-Nazi symbol they like of a N with a sort of a line up through it. So you have these guys who are very openly Nazis. They admire Hitler. They despise these ethnic Russians. They want to have pure Ukrainian blood and this sort of stuff. And as much as the New York Times and the Washington Post have tried to play it down, the Times even had a major piece about the Azov Battalion defending the city of Mariupol, a long, long article, and didn't bother to mention anywhere in the article what the political nature of the Azov Battalion was. Even though you would think that would be newsworthy, but it didn't fit with the narrative of, you know, these great defenders of civilization fighting these Russian, ethnic Russian barbarians at the gate. So they left out the fact these are a bunch of Nazis. But that has now come back up, although it's been ignored by the New York Times and Washington Post, but there was an extraordinary amendment to the defense bill that was passed. It was a bipartisan proposal and passed unanimously. That the United States military, which is now going into Ukraine to train Ukrainian forces to carry out the war in the East, that they should not be training the Azov Battalion because they're a bunch of Nazis. So you have this extraordinary story, but it's one that's being told by the mainstream U.S. media in kind of a fantasy way, in a fairy tale way, where one side is good and perfect and shares American values, et cetera, and the other side is evil and dark and really just brainwashed with Russian propaganda, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty remarkable moment as we sort of plunge into a new Cold War with nuclear-armed Russia and nuclear-armed the United States without really having thought it through, without any kind of serious evaluation of the actual events. We're sort of operating in this propaganda land is sort of the same kind of groupthink has seized Washington D.C. that we saw seize Washington D.C. back in 2002 and 2003, when everybody just knew that Saddam Hussein had all these weapons of mass destruction, and now we're seeing the same kind of groupthink apply to Ukraine, really with many of the exact same individuals involved in the news media. It's not even like the people that got Iraq all screwed up and wrong were punished. You still have Michael Gordon at the New York Times as their national security correspondent. You've got Tommy Friedman as the super columnist for the New York Times. You have the same editors at the Washington Post and at the editorial page, Fred Hyatt, people like that. These are the same people that misled the American people into the war in Iraq. And they're now misleading the people into a Cold War, a possible nuclear showdown with Russia. So it's a pretty extraordinary moment, but it's being treated in a rather cavalier fashion, I'm afraid.
Well, my guest is Robert Perry, and we could thank the Internet for getting information, because I was just thinking and listening to you, if we had to rely on the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, we would know nothing. I want to go back to Victoria Nuland Kagan. I mentioned earlier before I called you, I reminded our listeners about the $5 billion that Victoria Nuland Kagan had bragged about the U.S. spending to a group of Ukrainian Americans back last year, which I do not recall seeing in the media. Actually, I played the live audio for our listeners at the time. But one of the couple of things that are curious to me. One, of course, is we hear Hillary Rodham Clinton, but we don't hear Victoria Nuland Kagan. Her husband, Robert Kagan, was one of the founders of the Project for New American Century and its successor, the Foreign Policy Initiative. And the Project for New American Century's main focus was overthrowing the regime of Saddam Hussein. And yet we have first Hillary Clinton appointing Victoria Nuland as her spokesperson, but then Obama appointing her as this very important position, the Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia. It's kind of mind-boggling, unless one sees Obama as a Trojan horse. Perhaps that's the image that comes to me when I think about his pushing this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement against the wishes of the Democratic Party, Labor, and so on. There's something really strange going on. Perhaps you could help us figure it out.
Well, there's no question there's something strange going on. This is Washington, D.C. But I think with Obama, he was, I think you have to understand him more as a fairly naive character. I'm not sure he had a particularly well-formed view of how to carry out foreign policy. He received a lot of attention because as a state senator in Illinois, he gave a speech opposing going to war in Iraq, and he certainly was right about what he said at the time. But it's not clear to me how he would have voted if he actually were in Washington. It's one thing for a state senator in Illinois to show bravery on something like that. It was something else to show if you were in the Senate and getting national attention. You know, almost all the ambitious Democrats fell in line behind the groupthink, and that included Senator Clinton, included Senator Kerry, it included Senator Biden. So you had a lot of these. You saw already the kind of pressures that are brought to bear on politicians in Washington, and the neoconservatives have an extraordinary power base here. They dominate the think tanks. They dominate the major news organizations, and in many cases, they've infiltrated because of the Reagan Bush 1 and Bush 2 years. They have great strength inside the government bureaucracies, and that's sort of where you find Victoria Nuland. She was she's a Foreign Service officer. She's considered a professional, not a political appointee in the pure sense. Obviously, when you get to the level of assistant secretary, you are a political appointee, but she comes out of the Foreign Service. And she's very close in terms of her political views with her husband, Robert Kagan. And I've known Robert Kagan since he was kind of almost a kid. Because I was doing Central America leading up to the Iran-Contra scandal. And he was one of the senior propagandists assigned to Central America. He became head of a group called the Central America Public Diplomacy Office. And the Public Diplomacy Office was a propaganda front, and it was essentially being run by the CIA, but you know, via a leading propaganda agent that had been placed over at the National Security Council named Walter Raymond. And Raymond essentially taught Kagan a lot about how you run propaganda and how you influence the American people, how you find where our hot buttons are and how to push our hot buttons. And this is what they used. and how you glue white hats on your side and you glue black hats on the other side. So all this was sort of was thought out and developed in the 1980s during the Reagan years with the expertise coming out of the Central Intelligence Agency, except now being applied not to some foreign country, but being applied domestically. So that's Robert Kagan's background. And he's your classic neoconservative. Especially on Middle East issues, you started seeing this development in the mid-1990s where the neocons were basically advising Israel, don't bother to negotiate anymore, we'll just do regime change. We'll get rid of these troublesome Arab leaders and we'll put in leaders that will let Israel basically dictate the terms to the Palestinians. And that became the basic idea of what became the Project for the New American Century in 1998. The first one on the list was Saddam Hussein in Iraq, but then the Assads in Syria, Iran was also on the list. And so they finally get a chance to implement this in the wake of 9/11 and Bush's and having George W. Bush in office, who sort of goes along. Now, they, despite the chaos and destruction that followed the Iraq War, and including nearly 4,500 dead American soldiers, the neocons never paid much of a price at all. They remained in place, both in the news organizations, the think tanks, and much in government. So you had someone like a Victoria Nuland who was moving up through the ranks, and Hillary Clinton understood the need, or in her view, the political wisdom of catering to the neocons. And because Hillary Clinton's been doing that for quite a while. As a senator from New York, she represented a lot of sort of neoconservative thinking. And she was, and that became part of her MO as Secretary of State. And Obama, too. You know, so Obama becomes, as president, he has more, he seems to be sort of a realist in certain ways, and in the foreign policy sense of realist, dealing with the world as it is, not as you sort of want it to be. But he was always under a great deal of pressure and influence from the neoconservatives and from a group that's very important here to understand, what you might call the liberal interventionists. This is where the Samantha Power people come in, Susan Rice. These are people who, coming from a human rights perspective, join in supporting these military interventions for regime change. So you have this kind of an alliance that builds up between the liberal interventionists and the neocons, because essentially they're arguing for the same thing, going in and overthrowing these different governments that the U.S. has trouble with, it doesn't like for various reasons. And Obama has always been sort of in between this. He goes back and forth. He'll tend to accept their arguments and not want to fight with them. But then maybe at the last minute, when they have some particularly crazy idea, he'll sort of pull back. He did that when they wanted to go to war in 2013. These groups wanted to go to war in Syria and bomb the Assad army to achieve another regime change. Except it was pretty clear by then that regime change would have been al-Qaeda taking over, or now the Islamic State taking over. So Obama pulled back. And he was helped by Putin. If you remember what happened, this is very important to understand, is that in 2013, Obama was working hand in glove with Putin. And basically, Putin was trying to be helpful to the United States. And he was helpful in avoiding what would have been a catastrophe in Syria by getting Assad to surrender his chemical weapons arsenal. And then Putin also helped put pressure on the Iranians to come to terms in terms of the nuclear program, and so you had Putin being of great assistance in many ways, but he ended up sort of offending in that sense the neoconservatives and some of these liberal interventionists who wanted to go to war in Syria, and the neocons wanted to go to war in Iran too. You know, bomb Iran was their slogan, if you remember. So Putin then goes onto the radar and becomes a target. And then we see what happens with Ukraine. Obama, I think in many cases, was like he was distracted by many other things. He wasn't as focused as he should have been. And he's been trying to appease these groups. In 2014, while much of this, some of this was going on, there was a very influential piece written in the New Republic by, of all people, Robert Kagan.
I remember that.
And edited by his wife, Victoria Nuland, who was Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs at the time. But the article trashes Obama's foreign policy for not being interventionist enough. And Obama is so shaken by this fact that Robert Kagan wrote an article in the New Republic that he invites Kagan to lunch at the White House to sort of try to appease him. And I was told by one person who was had knowledge of the meeting, he called it like a meeting of equals. So Obama's treating this guy, Kagan, who was one of the architects of the Iraq war fiasco and does an article for the New Republic of all magazines. Obama's so impressed by this that he invites the guy to lunch at the White House. So, I mean, what you've seen here with Obama is, I think, I'm not sure he's ever really had a clear idea of what he wanted to do with foreign policy. And I think he's been allowed himself to be, he wavers between one side and the other. I think the essentially the interventionists have sort of won the day with him, unless he changes his mind at some point in the future. But he's, but what we see here, I think, is a very weak, indecisive president who can be convinced by all these fancy people in Washington that, oh, you've got to support free trade and these free trade agreements. They work so well with NAFTA, you know. And so you have, he's sort of a conventional in many ways when it comes to what the prevailing views of official Washington are. People in official Washington, if you're a serious person in Washington, you believe in these free trade agreements. If you're a serious person in Washington, you believe in having a new Cold War with the Russians. If you're a serious person in Washington, you want to bomb Assad, even though that would open the gates of Damascus to all kinds of hellish behavior by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda.
One of the things that troubles me is that Robert Kagan, who is John McCain's foreign policy advisor, the last thing I heard was that he was also Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisor. He has given his support to Hillary Clinton. So we're going to have neocons on both sides. But what do you think the likelihood, if she is elected the president, appointing Robert Kagan to a major cabinet post, national security advisor, or even secretary of state?
Well, one of the points, if you bother to go find that article he wrote, it's a very long-winded, rather pompous article, but in the New Republic, what you see there is that Robert Kagan says, I'm really not a neocon anymore. I'm a liberal interventionist.
Yeah.
and I'm really for Hillary Clinton. You know, I share her views. Now, Hillary Clinton it's sort of a political problem for her, is that no one really believes what she says, I don't think. I mean, some people do, I suppose, but a lot of people do not believe what she says. They don't believe she's sincere. They believe that she's saying what she needs to say politically, but they have no idea how that will translate if she ever gets into office. But whether or not, I would say probably Kagan is maybe less likely to get a top position in her administration, but Victoria Nuland might well. Obviously, Hillary Clinton was a key figure in promoting her, both to being the spokesperson for Clinton's State Department, but also she was a factor in getting her the job as assistant secretary, although her appointment ultimately came under when Kerry was Secretary of State. So what you have here is you have sort of this deep-seated set of relationships in Washington that where the neoconservatives have been very skillful, and one has to hand it to them, both in spreading around money, which is always helpful in Washington, because they have all these sources of funds, including $100 million-plus for the National Endowment for Democracy. But there's also plenty of other money that comes in through the defense contractors donating money to these think tanks, and the think tanks then provide jobs for people, often if they've left the government or, you know, are waiting to get into the government. So that money talks, and so you have these almost governments in waiting in Washington, but it's become, because of the influence the neoconservatives have been able to exert, it's almost seamless now. It's not like a major break between one government, or, you know, Democrats come in and then it's a big shift from the Republicans and vice versa. There's a lot of everyone sort of shares these views now.
Robert, this is a fascinating exchange. I would love for it to go on, but we've come to the end of the hour.
Okay.
I want to thank you for a very fascinating interview and explanation of what's going on for our listeners. I look forward to the next time we talk. So thanks so much
Sure.
for being
you.
Our guest again for Takes on the World.